Welcome to 20 Minute Takes. My name is David DeLeon, and I help to produce this podcast. This week's episode is part two of our interview with Andre Henry. Andre is a musician, activist, and author of the recently released book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep. This week, Nikki and Andre talk about what happens when American Christians imagine God in their own image, how faith can help to fuel social change, and how liturgy can be subversive. If you want to listen in on the first part of this interview, I'll put the link in the description. Otherwise, if you're all caught up, sit back and listen in.
In your book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, you talk about Jesus being a white friend you couldn't keep. Can you say more about that?
Well, I wanted to be clear that I said that I talked about white Jesus being a friend I couldn't keep because I didn't realize that the folks that I worshiped with and that I prayed with for so long, and I don't think that they know this, but it occurred to me in the summer of 2016 that these people basically imagined Jesus to be a larger version of themselves.
Wow.
It's funny. There was this study. I don't know if it made it into the final cut. I can't remember. But there was this study in America for people to describe what they think God looked like.
Uh-huh.
And then they made a composite sketch.
Oh, no.
Of this.
Oh, no. Tell me there was a picture. Was there a picture yes, in the study?
Yes, there is a picture. There's a picture of this composite sketch. And God is male, yes. And uh-huh. God looks like a worship leader from my youth group.
Oh, no.
When I was growing up. You know what I mean? Like just.
I know exactly what he's wearing. Yeah. I can totally picture it. Yeah.
He's a white guy. And I remember at the time, you know, before I wrote the book, you know, I lived through all this stuff. And I remember that summer thinking about white pastors who mm-hmm. I would talk to who refused to talk about racism, refused not just to talk about racism, but even to pray for victims of police violence, pray for these families who lost their kids or whatever. You know, there was just no concept of how they could engage God in light of what was happening in the world. But some of them outright refused. And some of them just told me, like one in particular just straight up told me in the chapter in that book that racism is not a priority to God.
Wow.
And then in the years following, you see things like the social justice statement from John MacArthur and all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So I literally was sitting there and like just weighing these things next to each other.
Yeah.
If white people told me my whole life, you know, God cares. I mean, on the simple, just the simplest principle, like you don't even have to get sociological with it, but just cast your burdens on Jesus because he cares for you.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So if you're burdened by your child having, you know, being diagnosed with cancer.
Yes.
You can pray about that because Jesus cares about that because Jesus cares about you.
Yes.
Right. And down to the silliest things, apparently, because I've heard of people praying for parking spots so that they can get the closest spot to the door and then get their avocados and all that kind of stuff. And you feel like that's something you can pray for because Jesus cares about you. Right.
Right.
And so I really put these things side by side. So wait a minute. You're telling me that Jesus, you know, who's apparently running the universe, according to Colossians, has time and, you know, space and has the motivation to help you find a parking spot at Walmart, but won't help Black people who are facing systemic, you know, oppression. And I think in really thinking about that, I went, oh my gosh, they think that God only cares about the things that white middle-class Americans care about.
Wow.
Because they think that God is one of them. And that took me all the way back through history because, you know, one of the first slave ships was named Jesus. Like they put.
Is that right?
Jesus of Lubeck, you know, if anybody is interested in it, just Google Jesus of Lubeck and you'll find one of the first slave ships has Jesus's name on the side of it.
No.
And I thought to myself, okay, well, could they have done that if they imagined that Jesus looked like the people they were loading onto that ship? You know, So they've been thinking that God is, you know, God is always the sponsor. You know, God is always a member of their group sponsoring whatever their political ambitions are. And I had this moment. It wasn't the first time. I'm not going to tell this whole story, but, you know, I had had at least one moment 2 years before that where I was in a church service and I'd learned something about the name of God in seminary. And I'm standing in the sanctuary and everyone's just like praising God. And they're, you know, they're just the emotion of a typical four square church. And I'm just standing there looking at the ceiling going, who are we talking to right now?
Oh, wow.
And then 2 years later, I'm on the floor in my living room going, oh my gosh, I know. They're talking to Steve.
So Steve being just this random...
The composite sketch, right?
Okay.
It's the composite sketch of them projecting their values as white middle-class Americans into the heavens.
Interesting.
And calling it Jesus. And I was like, okay, well, I can't keep that. I can't keep that God who will not, you know, come to the aid of the oppressed. You know, I can't keep that God, you know. So luckily, you know, it's funny, you know, Nikki, like the other day I found like some white Christians on the internet that made some nasty video about me. And the case they were trying to make was that when I worked for Relevant Media Group that they hired an atheist, right? Oh. And I'm like, I was an atheist for like an afternoon. Like, I was like, the whole thing is fake. And then like, you know, like within the hour, I was like, oh, but like God completely like liberated the Israelites because of systemic oppression. So I think I can worship that guy.
I see. Well, I love how you talked about in your book, you quote Michelle Alexander, right, who's the well-known author of The New Jim Crow. And as she's joining Union Theological Seminary, that, and I'm going to quote her as you've quoted her in the book, without a moral or spiritual awakening, we forever remain trapped in political games fueled by fear, greed, and the hunger for power. Can you say more about how a faith-fueled engagement works?
For sure. I mean, and I still consider myself someone who is very much in recovery from religious trauma, you know, for religious trauma. And so one of the big challenges in my life, you know, because of the movement, not because of the movement, but because of seeing just how deeply entrenched racism had been or is in the faith that I grew up in, or I've been, I have to figure out what does spirituality look like for me? What does faith look like for me in a decolonized way, you know? And the challenge of doing that is we don't know a world outside of colonialism. So these quote, like the quote that you just mentioned, the fact that Michelle Alexander even joined Union Theological Seminary for a time, and that Michael White, the co-founder of Occupy Wall Street, in his book was talking about the spiritual. Like I did say I kind of came back to like a more liberative understanding of faith, like within the afternoon, but I don't think that faith is static, right? Like it's dynamic. So there's so many days when people would be like, so what do you believe? And I just like, I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. Right. But the thing was, I remember being like, I don't want to talk about spirituality. I don't want to talk about theology. I don't want to be bother with those things because everybody who's involved in that stuff seems to just not be concerned with, they're just spiritual bypassing is what I'm saying, right? But I kept running into people of faith as I studied nonviolent struggle without even trying to. Like I wasn't looking for faith-based resources. I was just looking at the history. And I would run into, you know, Gandhi, whose faith very much influenced him. And he was influenced by, or it was at least conversation partners with, Leo Tolstoy. And we know that Tolstoy's, you know, view of nonviolence really is heavily articulated in his book, The Kingdom of God is Within You.
Yes.
Right? And his idea was basically, we need to end all war and everyone just needs to follow the Sermon on the Mount. And that, you know, their work influenced King and down the line. And I just kept running into, you know, faith, religion, spirituality, even Jesus. I, Jesus just kept showing up as I was studying these texts. So I feel like, you know, there's so much I could say about this, but half the battle is intangible.
Wow.
Half the battle is intangible. Hmm. And there's so many ways that people could language that if they want to, you know, but I do think that it's appropriate to call that intangible realm spiritual, you
wow.
know,
yeah,
because it has to do with essence, right? It has to do with consciousness. It has to do with how the stories that we believe and that we tell and all that kind of stuff, how that influence us on this invisible level that can't be touched through, you know, it can't be, okay, I say this all the time, but if there was a successful armed struggle by the united, you know, global majority, and they raise white civilization to the ground, you know, and they start something new, right? Guns and weapons and stuff like that can't touch that intangible realm of cultural values that, you know, that guide what we do. And I think that's why Dr. King near the end of his life was saying we need a revolution of values. So I think what that looks different for different people, you know, depending on what their tradition is.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But I know for me, I really had to come to grips with the fact that for as much as I have had doubts in my life because I think that's what calamity does. That's what James Cone says, like calamity brings doubt, you know, that I believe what I believe, or I've learned much of what I've learned about social justice because I read the prophets in high school.
Wow.
You know, and I learned from Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Amos and all of these people that, you know, idolatry and injustice go hand in hand. And that's why God hates it so much, you know, and that God hates injustice. I learned from Psalm 82, where God is walking in among the judges of Israel and saying, what's going on in here? Take care of the needy, you know, all that kind of thing. And so for me, you know, even though I have been afraid of alienating people who don't share the same faith, you know, that the truth is, like, that has brought me into this work. That's what gave me the values that drive me, you know? And so I'm working from that place, is that I may not know. I stay away from, like, some of the stuff that I was raised on, which, like, in the beginning of the book, you already know what kind of culture I came from, right? Like, charts, John Hagee on stage at TBN with charts and diagrams. This is how the world is going to end, right? Like, I stay away from, like, detailed prophecies about how things will turn out. But, you know, I do feel like the love of neighbor, the love of your neighbor is the thing that drives me. And I think that, you know, people can take from their traditions, you know, the thing that makes sense for them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's fantastic. You mentioned as something outside of the Pasadena police station, maybe it's a protest, maybe it's a vigil, but the phrase that you used was a subversive liturgy. Can you say more about what that means?
Yeah, the subversive liturgy came about after J.R. Thomas, my neighbor, was killed by the Pasadena police, and a bunch of us at Fuller Seminary, where I was graduating from, you know, we decided that we wanted to do something. We wanted to respond in some way. And so what we decided to do was build a memorial to J.R.'s life at the doors of the Pasadena police station.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because the police were the ones that caused that grief in the neighborhood. And it wasn't fair that the neighborhood should have to look at, you know, these memorials to J.R. Thomas in the neighborhood. And they get to not see that. So we wanted to put a reminder at their door. We figured that they would take it down. So we created a system from the get so that this memorial would regenerate. So they would take it down and there would be another memorial there at the doors of the police station by the end of the day. And it was like
the never ending memorial. It never ran out.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like, this was like the first creative direct action that I ever really organized. Like, I'd been a part of some before, but it was the first one that I organized. And so we didn't know what we were doing.
Okay.
We didn't know anything about social movement theory and all that kind of stuff like I know now. And I wish we did, because we could have made it more disruptive. But basically what ended up happening is we did what came naturally to us. All of us that were there, a part of that group in the beginning, were seminary students. So, you know, we were Christians, and the first night we just kind of stood there because we didn't understand that a stick of incense takes about 45 minutes to burn out. We didn't want to.
That's a long time.
Yeah. We didn't want to burn anything and leave it burning at the police station because it's illegal. So, and we don't want to break the law for no good reason, you know?
Right.
So, all right. So we're standing around this incense stick, not knowing it's going to take about an hour to burn out. And we didn't plan anything to do for that hour. Uh-huh. So we really just stood there in silence, like for, I think, the whole time, if I remember correctly. It's been a while. But anyway, because burning the incense would require us to be there for at least an hour, naturally, as we continued to do it, and we started daily, eventually we went to weekly, but daily being there for an hour, that time started to become filled with reflections and prayers and songs, and was just kind of becoming like this prayer service, this vigil, where we connected this one death in the neighborhood to all the deaths, of Black people at the hands of the state. And then eventually I said to Lauren Grubaugh, who you know, because Lauren was a part of that group, the Reverend Lauren Grubaugh, we should make this a weekly vigil and really plan it out, actually. And so that's what we did. Our team became kind of like a team of liturgists, and we would compile prayers and songs and spiritual practices and things like that. But the focus of the liturgy was the prayers of the people. That was what we took. And so that was the whole point. You know, like some church services, you go and the main event is the preaching, or the main event is the Eucharist.
Yes.
The main event at the subversive liturgy was the prayers of the people. We want people to be able to name what they are experiencing in the presence of God in relation to racial justice.
Yes. Wow.
It was so crazy to me how this thing grew, because we ended up having, you know, people from all over that area, the San Gabriel area, you know, some from like LA proper, you know, coming out to this, and from all kinds of different walks of life, not just Black people, you know, there are LGBTQ people. And, you know, we had some rabbis come through. We had, you know, people from all kinds of different Christian traditions come through. And then by the end, you know, we even had like pagans, you know, people who self-identify as pagans coming and being a part of this group. And I was like, I thought that was super interesting, because I was like, we really call on Jesus, you know, like we really do. I mean, there was even one during Advent service where like I was like praying in tongues, like out loud, which I don't usually let anybody hear me do that. But and so they were like, yeah, we just translate it for ourselves. But it became really this space where people were really finding healing and community, you know, and where some people, you know, who were coming from an evangelical background like I had, were connecting the dots between their faith in Jesus and social justice.
Yeah. I love that. You get a whole bunch of seminarians at the front end of a protest vigil. You end up with a subversive liturgy.
Oh, yeah. And so, like, I know a lot of people didn't know what either of those words meant. They're like, I don't really know what subversive means, and I definitely don't know what a liturgy is, you know. But I remember saying to Mike Kinman, who's a pastor at All Saints Church right across the street from the police station, and he was anointing the floor with oil. He's Episcopal priest. And he said, so what are we calling this? And I was like, well, we were trying to think of like a cool name for it, and then like, you know, subtitle a subversive liturgy, but we couldn't think of a cool name, so we just called it a subversive liturgy. And he goes, I like that. I think all liturgies should be subversive. I was like, I agree. You know, but I think that there's this connection between worship and justice that we were making as well. You know.
Well, Andre Henry, thank you so much for joining us. Andre Henry is a singer, he's a songwriter. Is the author of All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, and he calls himself a sometimes activist. Thanks so much for joining us here on 20 Minute Takes.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
$20 20 Minute Takes is a production of Christians for Social Action. This podcast is hosted by Nikki Toyamasito. The music is by Andre Henry. This episode was edited by Eddie Koffoltz and produced by me, David DeLeon. If you want to learn more about our work, you can visit us at christiansforsocialaction.org. If you've appreciated this podcast, please give us 5 stars on your podcast platform, write us a review, and share this with your friends. As this is the end of our first season, we would love to hear from you. Anything that you appreciated from season 1, an episode where you feel like you learned something really important, any suggestions you might have for guests or format, anything, we want to hear from you. Email us at info@christiansforsocialaction.org. Put 20 Minute Takes in the subject line. Thanks again for listening to our first season, and keep an eye out for season 2.